Hi, Greg Perry, the historic preservationist. Welcome to season 3, episode 98. So today we're going to be talking about English Regency furniture. Regency England, with its nobility and gentry, its merchants and shopkeepers, has long faded from many of our memories as historians. The painted stucco buildings, now fast disappearing, and the graceful furniture with its Grecian ornament are our chief mementos from the Regency world that we once knew. The journal of a French-American citizen, Louis Simon, carries us back to those years, for when we visited England in 1810 to 1811, he noted many things that interested him about the customs and habits of English society. For instance, we learned from his entertaining journal that not until 10 o'clock in the morning, when the shops began to open, did there appear any signs of life in the neighborhood of fashionable Portman Square. And it was not until 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon that the members of the Beau Monde began to make their appearance, when they left cards on friends, visited the shops, or even lounged in Bond Street. But by 5 or 6 o'clock, all had returned home to dress for dinner. From 6 to 8, the noise of wheels increases, for, as Simon relates, it is the dinner hour, and the carriages go at full speed, shaking both the pavements and the houses. Stopping suddenly, a footman jumps down, runs to the door, and lifts the heavy knocker, gives a great knock, then, suddenly, smaller ones in quick succession. Then, with all his might, flourishing as a drum, with the art and with an air and the delicacy of touch, when denote the quality, the rank, and the fortune of his master. We also learn from his journal how the quality entertained their friends by holding them, calling routs. On that occasion, the house was often stripped of its furniture to make room for all the guests. The rout was a particular form of entertainment. Since it's such a gathering, nobody sits. There is no conversation, no cards, no music, only elbowing, turning and winding from room to room. Then, at the end of a quarter of an hour, escaping to the hall door to wait for the carriage, spending more time upon the threshold among footmen than you have done above stairs with their masters. From this route you drive to another, where, after waiting, your turn to arrive at the door, perhaps after a half hour, the street being full of carriages, you, alight, begin the same round, and the end of the same manner. London, according to Simon, was divided into west and east. In the former resided the rich and the well-heeled and the idle, and in the latter the merchant, the trade class, and the businessman. In order to emigrate from the east to the west, it was necessary to have an income of at least £3,000 a year. For if you had less, or spent less, you might find yourself slighted. In fact, £6,000 a year was a safer limit. There they lived on much smaller incomes than the west, but this was a privilege not allowed to the city immigrant. In fact, the permission of fashion, Simon records, often affected poverty so that he might not be mistaken for a rich intruder. The London dwelling house also receives Simon's attention. He comments with some surprise that, not as in France, each family, except among the very poor, has a house to itself. These narrow houses, he writes, 3 or 4 stories high, one for eating, one for sleeping, and a third for company, a fourth under for the kitchen, a fifth perhaps at top for the servants, and the agility, the ease, the quickness with which the individuals of the family run up and down these stairs are amazing, and perch on the different stories, give the idea of a cage with its sticks just like that of a bird cage. Houses were also of different types. The rent of the middle class ranged from £80 to £200 per month, with the sum included all the rates. The mansions of the nobility and gentry, such as those of the fashionable squares of Portsmouth and Berkeley, were in some cases 1,000 a year, whilst others in adjacent streets were 100 to 500. Simon tells us that the nobility and gentry lived throughout the winter months at their country mansions, because at this time of the year they were able to indulge in their favorite sport, fox hunting. But the 6 months of spring and summer, which were not the season for field sports, they spent amidst the dust and smoke of London. These descriptions of people and houses, written at the time, help to give an impression of the original settings of the furniture with which is known today as Regency, but was called by our great-grandfathers Grecian. It was made by many firms of cabinet makers and upholsters, and it differed widely both in type and quality, for it was designed for several grades of society, and cost was the ruling factor in its production. For the nobility, nothing was too expensive or too good, and this probably applied to the new rich merchant as well, except in his case, his methodical mind made him ask the price beforehand, and he paid already much money for the object, proceeding seldom followed by the noble lord. The next grade of furniture was not so ambitious or elaborate in design, although of good craftsmanship and material. It was made for those who were not so rich but well-to-do, such as the class formed by the business or professional men, who lived in one of the less fashionable quarters, similar to the then recently built district of Bloomsbury. A third grade of furniture, which was a distinct standard lower, both in workmanship and material, was made for the small tradesmen or wage-earning citizens, who, with no thought of being in the fashion, lived in a simple house. If he was a shopkeeper, this was often above his shop. Because of the war with France, business was good, and this in turn affected both the shopkeeper and the hand craftsman, who, being kept very busy serving the new rich, were now able to afford new homes and new custom-made furniture. All three grades of furniture were produced in London, but in the provincial cities and towns, the second and third grades were only made. The nobility and gentry did not go to the local cabinet makers and upholsters for the furniture and drapery of their country mansions, since it was beyond the skill of such provincial tradesmen to produce work which was either good enough in quality or even fashionable enough in design to please the fastidious taste of the aristocracy. The so-called Regency style made its first appearance in London during the last years of the 18th century. It was based on the French Empire style, and its chief characteristic was its plain and severe classical treatment. Egyptian ornament was also introduced due to Napoleon's campaign in Syria and Egypt, and this ornament likewise found its way across the English Channel. The new Grecian taste in England was first expressed by the Carlton House, the London residence of the Prince of Wales. The Prince's architect, Henry Holland, was the premier pioneer of the new fashion. His known work in decoration and furniture at Carlton House and elsewhere shows how largely it debated to the French Empire style itself, for not only did he copy its ornament, but he also borrowed its structural forms as well. This is especially noticeable in his furniture. So during the last decade of the 18th century, French fashions were much in the vogue in London and throughout the world, owing to the presence of a number of refugee craftsmen who had sought sanctuary in England from the Revolution. Several of these French craftsmen worked at the Carlton House, probably under the direct supervision of Henry Holland. The fashionable and new Grecian style began to be adapted to furniture by the London chair and cabinet makers. As these craftsmen had done so many times in the past, they borrowed ornament and grafted it onto traditional English forms of their furniture. For unlike Henry Holland, an architect, they were furniture makers. The structural form of their furniture was to them an inherent feature of their craft, and one, therefore, they did not really abandon. Thomas Sheraton's first book, The Cabinet Maker and Upholsterer's Drawing Book, is evident of this. For the ornament is mostly Louis XVI, and the structure of the chairs, tables, cabinets, and bookcases belongs to the English tradition. In his second book, The Cabinet Dictionary, 1803, the new Grecian ornament had begun to appear, and here, again, although several of the structural forms are new, being copied from the French, they still have an unmistakable English character. The new type of couch is illustrated, one which Sheraton calls a Grecian squab. He adapted the design from a French, but still possesses a number of features which identify it as belonging to an English idiom. In the dictionary, Sheraton illustrates numerous other articles of furniture in the Grecian manner. Among them, chairs which he entitles Herculeums. The name was taken from the buried city of Herculeum for designs from its excavated ruins, and those of Pompeii had on publication, inspired furniture makers with new forms adapted from Roman examples. So in the text of the dictionary, Sheraton gives a long account under the heading of Grecian, which rambles on from architecture to dining tables and to a description of how the Greeks sat at their meals. He illustrates his design of the Grecian dining table, which is a semicircular plan with sofas, and in the center of the semicircular stands a dumbwaiter. His Grecian designs show the new reading, a decoration which was a distinguishing feature of the Regency style. Being employed for ornamentation, the edges of tabletops and shelves, table and chair legs, bed pillars, and many other parts of the furniture of the time. Sheraton, from 1803, the date of the publication of his Cabinet Maker's Dictionary, to 1800, the year of his death, was engaged on an ambitious work titled The Cabinet Maker, Upholsterer, and the General Artifacts Encyclopedia. He lived to publish only a small part from A to C, which appeared in 1805. The designs of the encyclopedia, all of which were Sheraton's fully developed Regency style, were in many cases prosperously bad, showing clearly he was good as a furniture designer, but only when he altered to tradition on paper only. And in his first book, he followed the traditional form of contemporary cabinetware, and his designs, in consequence, had a grace and elegance emphasized by his use of tastefully chosen ornament. In his second book, The Dictionary, his designs began to show decoration, for restraint in the use of ornament, and the daintiness of form in his chairs and tables. Features so prominent in his early work were now giving way to a fussiness of detail and elaboration of form due to his wish to give an article a novel and striking appearance. But the encyclopedia designs show how Sheraton completely forgot the learning of his craft and sought only for the novelty of the moment. His ornament, now overwhelming and distorting the form of his furniture, instead by adding it to its elegance and accentuating its constructional lines, as it had done previously, no longer existed. Another entirely different source of Regency furniture design was a book titled Household Furniture by Thomas Hope. Published in 1807, Thomas Hope, who was a member of the Dutch firm of bankers, had settled in England about 1794, in fear of a French invasion in the Netherlands. He was a wealthy dilettante, a collector of Egyptian, Greek, and Roman antiquities, also an archaeologist, and he had, it was said, an architectural training. He lived on Duchess Street, London, and also at Deeptone, Surrey, the decoration and furniture of which latter residence is illustrated in many museums today. His chairs, tables, stands, and cabinets are relatively simple in form. In some cases, they have been adapted from Roman furniture, with Egyptian, Greek, and Roman-type ornaments added to them. Owing to his friendship with the French architect Perassier, hopes furniture had more in common with the French Empire style than with the Regency style of the English cabinet and chairmakers, and Thomas Sheraton in general. In his furniture design of an article, what he strived to was to be dictated by its construction and material only. For many of his chairs, tables, and stands have the appearance of being of a stone or metal construction instead of being of wood. It was because of this defect of the contemporary critic described Hope's furniture as too bulky, massive, and ponderous to be commodious for general use. Another book of furniture design was that of George Smith, entitled A Collector or Collector of Designs of Household Furniture. It appeared in 1808, but its plates are dated from 1804 and 1807. As in Hope's work, Egyptian as well as Grecian ornament is extremely used by Smith. Unlike Hope, was commercially minded, and accordingly spread his net wide, including many numerous articles of furniture in the Gothic taste as well. Many of the designs equaled in over-elaboration and grotesqueness of Sheraton's own furniture in his encyclopedia. Smith dedicated his book to the Prince of Wales, stating that he had been appointed by His Royal Highness Upholder. George Smith in 1826 produced a second book of furniture designs, The Cabinet Makers and Upholsters Guide. It illustrates the last phase of the Regency style, when furniture became coarse and decorative in detail and cumbersome in form. The commercial age was beginning, when craftsmanship gave way to the improved methods of machine production, which led to lower cost and increased output at the expense of quality and authenticity. To what degree the published designs of Sheraton, Hope, and Smith were copied by furniture makers is very difficult to conclude, for seldom does one meet a Regency piece that can be identified with one of these authors' designs. Sheraton's dictionary probably had the widest circulation in the furniture trade, for the list of subscribers was well over 420 names of individual chair and cabinet makers and upholsters, the majority of whom probably lived in London alone. Hope's household furniture must have been looked upon by furniture designers as a valuable repository of Grecian and Egyptian ornament, since it contained a large selection of motifs that were not to be found elsewhere. It was an expensive work, however, and therefore likely to be in the possession of the smaller and less successful furniture-making firms. The outstanding difference between Sheraton and Smith's designs, both of which show a large variety of articles, all more or less of the same type of ornate character, and the Regency furniture that is extant is that the latter is simpler in treatment than that of the consequence, much better aesthetically. But undoubtedly, the reason for this was was that all the majority of chair and cabinet makers worked on traditional lines and did not seek for novel effects as Sheraton and Smith did. Also, it was found more difficult to produce elaborate designs in the workshop than on the drawing board. The London firms, especially those who served the nobility and gentry and the new rich, were the chief seekers after novelty, whereas the provincial and smaller firms were content to make furniture of the generally accepted and current patterns and designs. Novelty seekers seized upon many pretexts to appeal to the public. After the death of Nelson in 1805, they designed chairs, couches, beds, and window draperies with naval and marine motifs, anchors, tridents, ropes, and dolphins. Sheraton, in his encyclopedia, shows a design of a Nelson chair, in which the front of the seat is supported by two dolphins. The back legs terminate in seagulls' heads with their beaks resting on the floor, and the back is decorated with a large anchor, and the arms and seat rails are ornamented with carved rope. No more absurd, costly, and uncomfortable chair could be contrived as this one. So one form, Messrs. Morgan and Sanders, called their premises Tragaphore House after Nelson's victory. Richard Brown, in his book Rudiments of Drawings, the Cabinet and Furniture Design, 1820, calls attention to this method of appealing to public sentiment. Many cabinet makers, for the sake of notoriety, ridiculous give the names to furniture quite inconsistent. Waterloo Feet, etc., were kind of crazy names. The furniture of the first grade for the nobility and gentry was invariably of London make, and because of its high quality in both material and craftsmanship, its production was necessarily quite expensive. The most favored woods used in the construction were mahogany and rosewood, in the form of finely figured veneers, satinwood, zebra wood, amboina, tulip wood, and that was kind of also employed to a lesser degree. The ornament was sometimes in the form of gilt ormolu mounts with a hand-chased finish, sometimes of carved wood, which was usually gilt in burnished gold and not polished, though, except in the case of dining room furniture, for which carved and polished mahogany was generally the accepted standard. Another finish to carving in this first-grade furniture was to paint on a gray-green tint to make the surface of the veneer to give it just a different type of ambiance, somewhat of age. And the polish of the furniture of this grade was of the highest order, being of a hard surface whose high gloss was actually polished to perfection. George Smith, in his book of 1808, makes some interesting remarks concerning the use of various woods for furniture of the best quality. Mahogany, when used in houses of consequence, should be confined to the parlor and bedchamber floors. In furniture, for those apartments, the less inlay of the other woods, the more chaste will be the style of the work, if the wood will be cut fine, compact, for the brightest quality. The ornaments may be carved clean in the mahogany, where it may be a requisite to make out paneling by the inlay of the lines. Let those lines be of brass or ebony. So in the drawing rooms, boudoirs, anterooms, or any other dressed apartments, east and west, India satinwoods, rosewoods, tulip wood, and other varieties of wood brought from the east may also be used. With satin and light color woods, the decorations may be of ebony or rosewood. With rosewood, let the decorations be mounted or the inlay of brass or bronze metal, though sometimes used with satinwood, has a cold and poor effect. It suits better on gilt work and will answer well enough on mahogany. So, the second grade of furniture lacked the extra finish to the carving and the chasing of the metalwork, also the superfine gilding of the ormolu mounts. The veneers were not so finely figured, and the polish was not so perfect. The woods employed for the carcass and the drawer linings were also of a lower quality than those of the first-grade furniture. In the provinces, furniture makers displayed less taste in design. Their chairs lacked the grace of form of those of the London-made chairs, and their case furniture was generally not so good in its proportions. The provincial craftsmen also often displayed little understanding in the choice of ornament. Sometimes it is out of scale with the article it decorates. Sometimes it is incongruous with the style and lacks any uniformity. And more often than not, it's over elaboration. This also applies especially to turning, destroys what otherwise would have been a good and pleasing design effect. It seems that makers in provincial towns, Birmingham, must have been the exception. They did not favor ormolu mounts and brass inlay. So, as a means of decoration, to the same degree as those of the London makers. So probably this was due to the difficulty in obtaining the mounts and the special skill necessary for the inlay work itself. Sheraton, in his Cabinet Maker's Dictionary, writes, Brass beads and small lines of brass are now much in use in English furniture. It looks very handsome in black rose and other dark wood grounds. Sheraton also mentions metal mounts. In the brasswork accepted for cabinet work, the French far exceeded this country, as well as in their manner of gilding and styled ornament ormolu. The elegance of their furniture chiefly depends upon their superior brasswork. I am informed, however, that there are one or two English brass foundries in London, not much inferior to the French, very close in fact. The chief characteristic of the furniture of the third grade was cheapness. Cheap imitations of mahogany and rosewood were sought. Beech stained and deal painted and grained were extensively employed as substitutes. Mahogany and rosewood of inferior quality were also used. The openness of the grain and the lightness of the weight of the former, and the poor color of the latter, however, were defects that were difficult to hide. Carcasses of pine, a cheap soft wood, and not the more expensive hardwoods, mahogany and oak, the same applied to drawer linings, for which either pine or a cheap variety of cedar wood, which Sheraton calls Havana cedar, was generally used in order to hide a softwood lining of pine. The interior of the drawer was often lined with a blue paper. Furniture of this third grade possesses little variety in design. It was decorated with either Grecian or Gothic ornament. Inlay in the form was scarcely ever employed, and carving of a coarse variety was sparingly used. Chair and table legs and bed pillars relied for their ornamentation on turning, a cheap and easy method to make a bold statement. In the provinces, this third-grade furniture, which was also extensively made for farm and cottage residences, was seldom veneered, being constructed in the solid of common woods. Before completing this sketch of English Regency furniture, the following brief description of Japan chairs was in order. This type of chair, which was made in two grades of quality, owed its popularity to the late 18th and early 19th centuries, to the high cost of mahogany, rosewood, and satinwood. It was made of beech, painted and varnished in various colors, black, cream, yellow, green, blue, and rosewood and satinwood graining. These chair frames were decorated with lines. Sheraton, in his dictionary, calls that and tells us that the black chairs look well with yellow lines and with small panels and borders of floral and Grecian ornament. The legs were turned, and chairs of the better quality were ornamented with carving and were in a joint-type construction. The seats were caned, but in the cheap, so chairs were made in a rush, and you can tell that. Sheraton mentions also that Japan chairs with rush bottoms were hired out for their entertainments and were so-called route chairs. So these were had like, you know, for if you had a wedding, these chairs, Japan chairs with the cane seats, would have been hired out for events. The cheap Japan chair was of stick construction, like the Windsor chair. The Japan chair of good quality and of joint construction was used extensively by the nobility and gentry and all well-to-do citizens for drawing rooms, boudoirs, and bedrooms, where its pretty ornaments and colors harmonized pleasurably with the more expensive satinwood, rosewood, and mahogany furniture. Its manufacture became a specialized branch of chair making, and makers who called themselves Japan chair manufacturers were numerous both in London and in the provinces. So, Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, I'm going to sign out, and that gives us a little bit of background of English Regency furniture. Three basic styles, and we didn't have this when we were in the William and Mary and Queen Anne. You would have always had the provincial type style, and then you would have always had the city type style. So as things became mechanized and, you know, furniture could be made quicker and simpler, and you could copy designs much easier, then the different levels became into play. So for the first time, and you know, this is the 1801, probably up into the Victorian time of the 1870s and 1880s. So, and this is the time when real craftsmanship tended to leave. Because even, you know, makers like Duncan Fife, they were heavily machined up, and this was not furniture that was made totally by hand. A lot of the ornament was hand, but done by hand. But even in early 1820s and 30s, carving machines were developed. So someone could do a basic, just say carving of a shell, they could put on a carve machine in the 1820s, and they could actually produce roughly 12 copies of fairly good quality, and then they could overcarve them by hand and apply them to whatever piece of furniture was in question. So that's how these things manifested themselves, and a lot was driven by commerce and the expansion of the factory, the beginning of the factory in those early 1800s. So okay, Greg Perry signing out. Thanks everyone out there for listening.